The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today, the ever-popular pharmacist Scott Gaver returns to the show, this time to spend an entire hour taking your questions. Scott blogs at Science-Based Pharmacy and Science-Based Medicine. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks, Desiree. I'm happy to be here, especially on Canada Day.
Oh, that's lovely.
So hopefully the fireworks will hold off until after the show is completed.
We're in different time zones. I think we're good.
Okay.
So always good to have you here. You always have a little disclaimer you like to give before we start taking questions.
Just like to emphasize that I don't want to imply that I'm giving out any medical advice on the air. It's important for me to emphasize that. I also want to emphasize that anything I say is really for discussion purposes only, and it doesn't represent the opinions of anyone that I'm group that I'm affiliated with or work for.
Yay for Scott not getting sued.
Thank you.
So let's get right to the questions that were submitted before the show, because there were many, many, many of them. So this one's from Nancy.
What's the difference between ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and acetylsalicylic acid? And what kinds of pain are they best for?
Yeah, this is a great pharmacology question. So we can divide these into two groups. So the ibuprofen and the acetylsalicylic acid, which is also called aspirin, those are called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So those drugs are similar in some ways. They're in the same type of category of drugs, but their side effect profile is a bit different, and they're used for different conditions. But the main thing to remember about the non-steroidals, or NSAIDs, which is NSAIDs, is they provide an anti-inflammatory effect, so they actually reduce inflammation, and then they also control pain, and they will reduce fever as well. So those products are kind of good for all three of those conditions, so pain, fever, and swelling. The acetaminophen, or Tylenol, provides pain relief, but it doesn't have any effect on swelling, and it also will provide fever control as well. So the main difference is whether it has an anti-inflammatory effect. So the acetaminophen is quite a different chemical, and so it works quite differently. They both provide good pain control, but only the ibuprofen and the acetylsalicylic acid, or ASA, will actually produce anti-inflammatory effects.
And so are there other benefits to using acetylsalicylic acid as well?
Well, ASA has an antiplatelet effect that is used for a demonstrated use in different types of cardiac conditions. So it's used for that effect. It has an effect on platelets that is quite sustained. So sometimes you can actually use a very small dose of ASA on a daily basis to have an antiplatelet effect. And that's a dose which you may see. So people will say they'll take 325 milligrams a day, or sometimes they'll call it what's called the baby aspirin, which there isn't baby aspirin anymore, but it's an 81 milligram strength of ASA, and they take that, which basically just has an effect on the platelets, doesn't have any effect on either pain or inflammation. So, and that effect is ASA has a permanent effect on the platelets, and so it can be taken once a day. The other drugs like ibuprofen in that category don't have the same prolonged effect, and so they can't be used in the same way.
Next question from Wanda.
I've heard cortisone weakens your bones. Is that true?
Well, cortisone, I'm not really sure which product the Wanda is referring to, but certainly the cortisone, like if we looked at cortisone, say, as a category of drugs, then we would definitely say that the long-term use of some of the cortisone products, particularly if they're taken orally, could have a negative effect on bone density. So when we talk about that, it would be, if you're taking something like prednisone, which is in the category of the cortisone-like drugs, and you were taking that on a regular basis for weeks, or actually really more for months or years, it could definitely have an effect on your bone density and your bone strength. Cortisone could also refer to something like hydrocortisone cream. In that case, you're using a very small amount, and usually hydrocortisone cream is used for things like you know, rashes on the skin. You're using a small amount. You're only using it topically right on the surface of the skin. And there just isn't the concerns that you have about those types of side effects with the drug that you would if you were taking it orally, where it would affect the whole body and you were taking it for a long period of time. So I guess the answer is yes, but it really depends on the dose and the total duration of how long it's being taken for and what it's being used for as well, because the dose does have an effect.
And a question from Joe. And this is one I've been wondering about for years.
Is creatine an effective supplement? How does it work?
That is a really interesting question that's, I think it's hard to say. I think the first question I would have is for what use? Because while it's used mainly for improving exercise performance and increasing muscle mass in athletes and in adults, it's also used for conditions like heart failure, depression, bipolar, Parkinson's, with, you know, mixed amounts of data in terms of the evidence of how effectively it works. So let's assume that it's being used for muscle mass, which is the most common use, and certainly that's where you see the younger adults using it most commonly. So creatine is produced within our bodies, and it's found mainly in skeletal muscle, so we can produce it ourselves. And fish and meat are both dietary sources that we can have as well. And when it's taken as a supplement, it seems to actually enhance the performance of very high intensity, short duration exercise. So things like, you know, lifting weights and conditions like that. It doesn't seem to have the same types of effects for long duration exercise. So if you're using it for, you wouldn't expect it to have a beneficial effect, say, in someone who's a distance runner, for example, because it doesn't seem to have that type of effects in terms of that high intensity, short duration work.
Oh, interesting.
So people who have lower amounts of creatine in their system, say maybe vegetarians, they seem to be more likely to respond to supplemental creatine. People who, you know, may have a lot of protein in their diet and with higher initial levels, they don't seem to respond as well. Now, for what it's worth, it can cause, you know, stomach pain, some nausea, cramps are pretty common. Also, it's interesting that, you know, the International Olympic Committee and most professional sports allow it to be used. So you can infer that it either works or doesn't work from that perspective, because it's not banned, which may speak to really to its lack of, you know, really clear efficacy versus its efficacy. So in terms of safety, it does seem to be safe as a supplement. But, you know, there's a lot of studies that have been done, and I think it really depends on the specific of the sport and what is actually being evaluated. And, you know, the diet of that, the diet of the person who's taking it, the age of the person, the dose. So there's a lot of different conditions. But it's actually quite interesting, because there's a lot of studies that have been done on this product. And so if somebody says, is it helpful or not, it's really, really difficult to answer. But, I mean, some studies do seem to suggest that it does improve muscle strength. So that's promising. I mean, it does look interesting, but again, is it going to be, it's not a panacea for everyone who wants to improve muscle strength.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Scott Gavura, the lovely pharmacist who blogs at Science-Based Pharmacy and Science-Based Medicine. This one's from Kelly.
Do the different vitamins and minerals in a multivitamin break down at different rates? What's a good rule of thumb for multivitamin freshness, assuming it matters to their effectiveness?
Another great question. So when we use the term multivitamin, it's used commonly. There isn't a standard meaning. So, you know, a multivitamin can be a combination of two vitamins, or it can be a combination of, you know, dozens of vitamins and minerals. So that when we say multivitamin, it can refer to any number of products. And there's little information around whether there are studies done to know to the extent to which the products are actually absorbed. Because if you think about, if we wanted to measure whether a multivitamin was being absorbed, and we wanted to know the individual component of each ingredient, say there's a dozen ingredients, then you'd need to actually do blood levels immediately after you've taken the multivitamin, kind of, you know, every half hour to every hour, and then try to measure to see what was the initial level and what was the rise, and
right,
then try to calculate that back. So it's pretty difficult to do. So what, in general, I mean, what most manufacturers do is they just assume that the product is dissolving in the stomach acid and that it's being, you know, that it's being absorbed. But it's very difficult for us to correlate whether, you know, a particular multivitamin is actually fully absorbed and the extent to which it's absorbed. You see a lot of claims around multivitamins that some manufacturers will, you know, make comments around. Other manufacturers say the product doesn't dissolve, or it's not absorbed, or our vitamins are absorbed you know, more completely, but there's really not any good information to guide us to really evaluate those claims. In general, what I suggest to people who are taking multivitamins is to take it with food. You know, certainly if it's there are cofactors or other components as part of our food that will help absorption, then it seems to make sense that, you know, taking with food would be helpful. As well, multivitamins can cause nausea, and so that's a factor as well. You know, when we look at whether a vitamin is absorbed, there's kind of like three main factors we look at. So the first is, you know, as I said, like those coatings and the bindings and everything that's in it that'll affect the disintegration of the product. The second is whether it's interacting with drugs or other foods. And then there's other factors just related to your ability to absorb certain vitamins or not. So I guess it's difficult to say. I mean, I don't know if I have a good rule of thumb for multivitamin freshness. I mean, certainly I would say to take products within the expiry date. And I usually recommend, you know, when people are asking me for brand recommendations, I'll recommend one of the name brands simply because companies that are been producing a particular multivitamin for years and they're the larger companies, I generally will have more faith that those products will meet, you know, typical drug quality standards in terms of the dissolution standards and the disintegration habits.
And Scott and I actually did an entire episode on vitamins. So if you'd like to hear more on that topic, just go to the website at skepticallyspeaking.com, click on the episodes tab and type vitamins into the search bar.
That was a good episode. Yeah.
That was a great episode.
And we didn't even get through all the vitamins, I don't think.
No, I know. Not even close.
We'll have to do the other ones at another episode sometime.
I think we were going to do a whole episode on supplements, actually. So
yeah,
we're cramping.
I think we need
that.
To do one just on minerals, vitamin, or just the mineral component. Because I don't think we did any minerals. We just did vitamins.
This is like the nerdiest conversation I've had in a while. Also, just since we're on that, because all of Scott's episodes are wonderful, if you want to just hear his appearances, type his name into the search bar, and that's Scott Guevara, because he's great. And on the topic of expiration dates, this one's from Julie.
What are the risks of taking expired medication? Does it matter which medication and how long it's been expired?
So I did actually a full blog post on this, and you can find this at the science-based medicine site if you search expired drugs. So I guess that there's no single rule for what to do with expired drugs because it really depends on the product, what the regulatory requirements are in that wherever you happen to live, and many other factors that can influence the safety and the efficacy. So I mean, you know, there are one of the products that expires very, very frequently is the EpiPen, which people carry around for, you know, if they have an anaphylactic reaction to something. So I'm certainly not going to suggest anyone even consider carrying an expired epinephrine injection because, you know, it's a life-threatening circumstance and they need to be using products that are within date. Unfortunately, epinephrine is just not a stable drug and so it expires very quickly. We're lucky when we get it in the pharmacy to get 18 months before it expires.
Wow, okay.
You know, with other products, you know, it may not be as much of an issue. In general, expiry dates are conservative and I think that, you know, the expiry dates are really there to give, you know, consumers the confidence that the labeling claims are accurate up to and, you know, up to and including the expiry date. But the reality is, and I find particularly, this is what I like to caution people, is that when you've been dispensed a drug, you know, there's an expiry date on the bottle, the big bottle that I take, and I put it into a smaller bottle and I, you know, you're getting that in your prescription vial, say. But the expiry date on the bottle is applicable to the bottle when it's still sealed. And when there's, you know, the desiccants and the things that remove the moisture from that package. Once the product has been transferred out of its original container, we don't have any information around what the stability is under those circumstances. And so generally for prescribed drugs, I suggest, you know, even under optimal circumstances, I would say a year would be the maximum. I would say that even for products that are over the counter where you're buying them and they're on the shelf, once you've been opened, I wouldn't have the faith that those products will maintain the full expiry if they've been opened. So when absolute certainty is required, stick to drug products that aren't expired. The other thing that I want to emphasize is don't flush your expired drugs. Take them back to the pharmacy in Canada. I think most pharmacies will take them back, and there's programs in the States as well that'll take back expired drugs. Don't flush them. Take them to the pharmacy and they're incinerated.
And why? Why, Scott?
We don't want drugs to show up in the water supply. They do already, but we want fewer of them to show up in the water supply. It also reduces the risks of things like diversion or just, you know, poisonings.
Lovely. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Scott Guevara, the science-based pharmacist, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by pharmacist Scott Guevara of the blogs Science-Based Medicine and Science-Based Pharmacy. Let's get to a few more audience questions. This one's from Fertilina.
How do bioidentical hormones work? Is there a difference in effectiveness compared to synthetic hormones? What are the side effects? And when and how can you go off them?
That's a big question.
Yeah, and I don't think I can do it justice because we could probably spend a whole hour just on bioidentical hormones. And bioidentical hormones are really interesting. I do have there's a blog post that I've done at Science-Based Pharmacy about this, and there's several posts on bioidentical hormones at Science-Based Medicine by myself and by other authors. So refer those for more detail. But bioidentical hormones basically is the treatment with hormones, which are identical to the hormones that are already present in our body. So hormone replacement therapy or hormone therapy is made up of a number of different products, some of which are chemically identical to hormones that our body already produces, and some are with slight differences. And so when we talk about bioidentical hormones, we're talking about ones that are identical. In general, when we're looking at kind of the safety and effectiveness, we rely on kind of the data of the largest and highest quality studies to guide us. And so generally, we need to make the same inferences regarding the efficacy and safety. And I think that the Women's Health Initiative study that was, it's quite old now, really put a scare into a lot of health professionals and into a lot of women, to be honest, regarding the relative safety and efficacy of using hormone treatments. And a lot of women, when the WHI study came out, went off that product. And at the time, that was a study that was made up with the main hormone was Premarin, which is a non-bioidentical hormone. And at the time, there seemed to be a push from pharmacies that manufacture bioidentical hormones, and from some groups, Suzanne Summers is a proponent, that bioidentical hormones were both safer and more effective. And there just isn't the data in place to really give us convincing evidence to assure us that that's the case. And I think that in general, when talking about bioidentical hormones or just hormones in general, we infer the kind of relative same amounts of safety and efficacy. And over time, our as we've looked at how hormones can be used, it seems that they can be used safely and they can be used in evidence-based ways. And the risks may be not as significant as were initially thought, but I don't think we can infer with really good evidence that bioidentical hormones are any safer than the synthetic hormones. But from a side effect perspective, they're generally the same, and you know how and when you go off them, it's the same between the two. So maybe I can leave it at that, and you know I can put some links in the show notes as well to some articles that discuss it in more detail.
That would be great. Also, I could do an entire episode on hormones.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic, mm-hmm. And you know, I have a perspective. My blogging has been more about the bioidentical hormones from the pharmacy perspective, because it's really kind of a pharmacy-driven product for a number of the products that are sold, which are the topical creams that are used. But there's a number of bioidentical hormones that are manufactured by, quote, big pharma as well. So, you know, there's it really comes down to a question of whether the products are manufactured within a pharmacy or whether they're manufactured in FDA inspected manufacturing facilities. And so there's the risks and benefit to both. And it really is a decision that needs to be, I agree that it does need to be individualized with women, and I think that it can be used safely, but it requires a consideration of a lot of different factors in order to proceed. And bioidentical hormones may be appropriate for some people, but it's not a universal good and better than synthetic.
And this question is from Forrest.
Which is better when trying to quit smoking, the nicotine vaporizer or Nicorette gum?
Yeah, that's another good question. I think that the short answer is we can't say definitively. I think that what the limited evidence that exists suggests that there isn't really clear overall differences in effectiveness in the different forms of nicotine replacement. So whether it's the vaporizer or the gum, I couldn't locate any head-to-head comparisons between, you know, a vaporizer or the gum. Now, it's not clear whether what's being referred to here is the vaporizer, which are the electronic cigarettes, or whether there is the there's also a nicotine inhaler that's actually manufactured by a pharmaceutical company as well. I think that when we're talking about the electronic cigarettes, those particular products are it's a little less clear that they are kind of consistent in delivering the consistent amount of nicotine, and whether they are as safe and as effective for smoking cessation as the products that are inspected and tested, required for testing for by the regulators, by like Health Canada or the FDA. But I think what we know is nicotine replacement is effective for helping to quit smoking. It seems to double quit rates. But for nicotine replacement to be effective, it needs to be taken appropriately. So, you know, most pharmacies can now can provide this, and most drug plans will provide a nicotine replacement. And in some cases, it really is, you know, again, it's individualized. Some people prefer patches, some people prefer gum, some people prefer the inhaler. And it really is a question of what works from your perspective if you want to quit.
And this one's from Monique.
Does Hoodia work for appetite suppression? And is it safe?
So Hoodia, this was popular a few years back. So Hoodia is a South African plant, and apparently it has traditionally been used as an appetite suppressant, and that's how it's claimed to work, is basically just reducing the appetite. So what's really interesting is there was a lot of interest in this, and then the big food manufacturer Unilever actually invested in a clinical trial that was published back in just published last year. And in that study, 42 overweight women were given Hoodia or a placebo, and they were told they could eat as much as they want. So, right, this product supposedly works as an appetite suppressant. So give them the product or a placebo and just let them to continue to eat as they want, and then track to see both the energy consumption and weight. And what they found is that it didn't have any impact on energy intake, that is, you know, how much you're eating, or on body weight, although it was a short-term study. But what was concerning is it caused a lot of nausea and vomiting, and it did raise blood pressure. So it doesn't seem that the product is all that promising as an appetite suppressant. So what little evidence we have where it's been studied seems to suggest it doesn't work as is touted.
But nausea and vomiting, I would suggest, does in fact suppress your appetite.
Yes, and that's what I thought was surprising too, because I thought if you're nauseous the whole time, it actually might work. But it didn't, which was surprising. So maybe it was a short-term nausea. But yeah, I would have thought that if you just take something that makes you nauseous all the time, then you wouldn't feel like eating and you would lose weight. But it didn't work that way. So maybe it was very transient.
From Robert.
How much money do Canadians waste on scam?
And by that he means supplementary, complementary alternative medicine.
There's been a few estimates. I tried to sort this out within Canada. I think that the best estimate is probably around $2 billion a year, or makes up what's called the natural health product market in Canada. So there's estimates that range between $1.3 billion in 2007 to $2.75 billion in 2010. So I can't give you a specific number because these are estimates based on different markets. There's a lot of small companies that are involved. And it also includes what are we including within that? Are we including vitamins? Are we taking vitamins out? Are we including calcium, you know, calcium supplements?
Does that fall into complementary alternative medicine?
Which one? Like vitamins or
calcium?
Calcium? I think it depends on what you're using it for.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, calcium can be used as part of a, you know, in an evidence-based way for treatment of conditions like, for the treatment of osteoporosis. You know, it can be used in other circumstances too. So I think it really depends on how you want to count, you know, something like calcium or the other minerals as well. But in any case, it looks like it's probably around, I don't know, $1.5 to $2.5 billion a year in Canada.
I could go off on a really big tangent right now, but I'm not going to. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Scott Guevara, the science-based pharmacist, after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today is Ask a Pharmacist Day with Scott Guevara of Science-Based Pharmacy and Science-Based Medicine. This question is from Nathan.
Pharmacists are often asked to sell homeopathic products alongside of herbs, vitamins, and over-the-counter medicine. How does a pharmacist deal with selling products that have such a diverse history of evidence supporting them? In other words, how do they come to terms with selling bunk alongside of proven medicine?
Sounds like a personal question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually a good question, and that's certainly a question that I like to pose to pharmacists as well. I think I want to emphasize first of all is that I don't place blame on individual pharmacists within pharmacies where products are being sold, just because of the nature of, you know, pharmacists can be staff, just like you could be, you know, if you're not the owner of the pharmacy, you may have little discretion in terms of what's being sold in front of the pharmacy. Even if you are, or if you're part of, say, a large banner or chain type pharmacy, you may not have the discretion in order to determine which products are sold or not. So I think that you'll find that far more pharmacists will provide factual evidence-based information about the lack of efficacy of homeopathy much more frequently than you'll see you know, the lack of homeopathy in pharmacies, unfortunately. So you will see it in pharmacies, but I think if you ask pharmacists that they will generally provide, you know, information suggesting the products lack efficacy. It is a challenge when we're talking in generally about, you know, products that are sold in front of the counter, the herbs, vitamins, and the other over-the-counter products. And I think that the challenge is that products have very different levels of evidence to support them. And I've written about this before, and that, you know, there's, and I don't want to imply that over-the-counter products will have good evidence of efficacy, because some of these products, just because they've been around for so many years and have a safe history of use, they may actually be sold and will lack good evidence of efficacy as well. And I think we've talked about this before, Desiree, around the cough and cold products, where there just really isn't good information to show that these products are good. And in children, it actually looks like the risks are outweigh the benefits. And so, you know, they've relabeled them in Canada and other countries to suggest they shouldn't be used in children. But the same thing applies to herbs and vitamins. And it really depends, again, on the country where you are and, you know, the regulatory status. But in general, there's different regulatory standards in place so that there is generally a lowered evidence bar. So products are allowed to be sold without meeting the evidence standards that would be in place for, say, prescription drugs. And unfortunately, that means that products may be advertised for claims for which there isn't good evidence of efficacy. And, you know, homeopathy is the extreme, because here we're talking about products that don't have, you know, that are inert. They don't have any active ingredients. And yet, you know, in countries like Canada, they're allowed to be sold with instructions or recommended uses, which would actually suggest that they can be used for specific purposes. So it is a challenge for pharmacists, I think, in order to provide that. And I think that we do try to provide, I certainly do try to provide information regarding what we know about the product and whether it works or whether it doesn't work, based on the best evidence that we have. And also to comment on the safety, because it's often the concern that we have as a pharmacist is if the product has, say, particularly with herbals, because an herbal product is really just kind of an impure drug, it may have, you know, dozens or hundreds of different chemicals in there. And if you're on a number of prescription drugs, I will not be able to say with assurance whether there is a potential for problems or drug interactions between the chemicals in your herb that you're taking and the prescription drug. And so your response to a question around whether it's safe or not will really depend on a number of different questions and kind of my general comfort with that particular product and what we know about it, and then also what we don't know about it. If it hasn't been well studied and, you know, you're on a, say, prescription drug, then I might have a different opinion regarding, you know, something where we have fairly good information to suggest that the product doesn't have a lot of harms and it's being used for some condition for which I don't have a particular objection. But I would be candid around the evidence around whether there's good evidence that's been evaluated to show that it works or not.
Before we get to the next question or the next couple of questions, maybe give us a brief primer on the placebo effect, because we have a lot of placebo-related questions, so we need some background.
Yeah, well, placebos are really pretty fascinating, and I we could do a whole show just on placebo effects. And I think that the most important thing when we're talking about placebos is you know, people will say the placebo effect is real, and the placebo effect is something that we can use and harness. And there's a lot of really long discussions about this in science-based medicine from all the different authors there. I think that the most important thing that we want to emphasize is, you know, when we're looking at a clinical trial, and we'll say whether the drug is more effective than a placebo or not. And then we'll, you know, often the placebo will have a particular effect. So you'll see, you know, if you randomize patients, that the placebo will have side effects, and there will be, you know, the placebo will have some effectiveness, it'll appear. The important thing to emphasize with the placebo is, when we talk about placebo, it's not a placebo effect, it's placebo effects, plural. And that means everything from whether things that patients report, whether they feel better or not. But the placebo effects can also include bias on the part of the observer. So, you know, if you are the physician in a clinical trial, and your observation of a patient, because you don't know whether they're on a placebo or not, you may actually subconsciously infer that the product is working. So the placebo effect can be a number of different factors that are kind of summarized together, and it's discussed as a single item. I think what we want to emphasize with the placebo, when we're talking about a placebo, is it's a treatment with an inert product. So you're giving a product with no medicinal ingredient, and then you're trying to determine what the effects are. And placebos, certainly really fascinating. I think the best evidence suggests that placebos don't seem to have objective effects, objective benefits. So when we're talking about using it objectively for treatment of things like asthma, patients who are given placebos for asthma conditions may subjectively report that they're better. But when we actually measure them using, you know, looking at their doing objective tests, they aren't actually better from that perspective. So it's the question of whether there's that subjective improvement is something that we think is appropriate or not. Do we want to actually, is a subjective improvement enough, or do we actually want to see objective improvements, whether a person improves or not? And I think it really depends on the condition or not. But there's a lot of misconceptions around placebo. And I mean, certainly I think what we're seeing when it comes to concerns around some supplements, and particularly homeopathy, there seems to be, you know, a shift where there's now an argument in some circles that it's, you know, the placebo effect is worth harnessing, and therefore we can use homeopathy, you know, just for harnessing the placebo effects. But the challenge is that if we're going to be giving a placebo and we want to harness placebo effects, then we really have to withhold information from the consumer or the patient, which is basically, we can't really tell them that the drug is a placebo and it doesn't have any effects, because that will potentially destroy the placebo effect. So hopefully that's not too confusing, but that's what I want to say. And that's why I think that the discomfort that I personally have with something like homeopathy, that you could say, well, people subjectively feel better when you look at clinical trials with homeopathy, and that's true. But if you actually want to harness that placebo effect, then you actually have to tell them that the product has an effect. You can't say that this product is inert and has no beneficial effects.
Which is vaguely unethical.
Yeah. I think it's not even vaguely unethical. I think it's our responsibility to provide, you know, objective information around placebos and around the products. You know, as a health professional, it's really my responsibility to provide the best information to the best of my knowledge. But it's also my responsibility to, you know, to be candid. And this is something, you know, Dr. Chris McDonald, an ethicist who you've had on the blog before or on your show before, and he writes at the Research Ethics blog, he's discussed this as well on his blog. And he argues that in situations regarding healthcare, you know, as a patient, you might not know the right question to ask. So as a consumer or as a patient, we rely on health professionals to be candid, to anticipate the questions that we're going to have, and to volunteer information that we think patients need to know. And that really, that type of candor is really a professional responsibility. So, you know, if there's placebos on the shelf in the form of homeopathy, I think that it's incumbent upon the health professional to provide, you know, information to patients to say that there isn't any evidence to show that these products have any objective effects.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. My guest on today's episode is pharmacist Scott Guevara, blogger at Science Based Pharmacy and Science Based Medicine. There is no human way to get to all of these questions, so I will try to get to as many as possible. The next question is from Yaroslav.
What is your take on nootropics, so-called smart drugs? Most of them are banned, but for example, paracetam is quite well researched and proven, but still illegal and only prescription-based. Do you think nootropics in future will be sold legally like vitamins?
Well, I mean, again, with nootropics, it's a category of products. A lot of the products in that category are stimulants, and you know, the use of stimulants goes back decades. I remember, you know, in like 1980s, there was like this after-school special with Family Ties when Alex was hooked on stimulants and uppers, and it was. You know, it terrified me. Maybe that's what drove me into pharmacy school years later. But you know, that was focused on stimulants then, right? That was back in the 80s. So stimulants are nothing new, and we can go back even further to talk about stimulant use. But it certainly seems like, you know, schools are the laboratories today. There was a piece in the New York Times in last month regarding teenagers and the abuse of stimulants who are grinding up and you know, snorting them. So do they actually enhance abilities? There's lots of anecdotes, but I'd say it's still not clear. So how much do they actually help? You know, how harmful are they? I think it's difficult to say what the side effects and the trade-offs really are. I mean, I think that the effects of the long-term use are, I would say, unclear. So I think it's difficult to say whether they're going to be sold legally like vitamins, because it's a pretty general purpose category of products. You know, I think as well, we're talking about using these products in ways that are off-label in terms of whether there are, you know, they're not being used in ways that they've actually been studied for. So a lot of these products are used for treatment of ADHD. And so if you're using them in people who don't have ADHD based on the definition that went into for the people that were studied, we don't really know. We can make inferences around what we know about how the chemical works, whether it might be potentially beneficial or not. My suspicion is that these products are probably very responsive to placebo effect. And so there's the potential that there could be, you know, placebo effects there that people would report that they're doing much better. But I think it's difficult to really objectively say whether they are improving or not. But I think it's a really interesting area. You know, but I think that it's difficult to make any kind of definitive conclusions about it right now. But hopefully there will be more studies. But I'm always a bit uncomfortable, you know, studying you know, we complain about, there's complaints a lot about disease mongering and creation of diseases by, right, you know, pharmaceutical companies. And this is a good example. So, you know, because here we are using a product in where there isn't a medical need for it.
This one's from Tanya.
I'd like to hear a pharmacist tell the truth about generic versus name brand drugs.
And truth is in capital letters?
I know the truth is that they are absolutely not the same. Since chemicals react with other chemicals, just having the same base drug does not mean equal effectiveness. There are other ingredients and strengths in them. Common sense dictates this, yet the pharmacists are trained to spew the lies that they are equal because there's big money in big pharma.
Scott.
Wow. The truth. All caps, the truth. So I will try to provide the answers about generic drugs. I've actually done a pretty long post about generic drugs, which I'll refer people to at Science-Based Medicine, but I can give kind of the highlights. You know, pharmacists are pretty familiar with generic drugs because in most countries, in most provinces and states, the pharmacist is choosing the brand of the drug that's dispensed. So if there's multiple brands of a particular drug, there's specific regulations about which generics can be used. And so to understand kind of the scientific basis of generic drugs, there's a few key concepts which I'll go through quickly, but I'll refer you to the post. The first is that every drug, when we talk about a drug, whether it's Tylenol or aspirin or Advil or Motrin, there's what's called the API, the active pharmaceutical ingredient. That's the active ingredient. That's what it says this pill contains, 100 milligrams of whatever. The API, that's what we want. So if we design, so say you're in a pharmaceutical lab and you're designing you want to design a dosage form. You want to make a tablet or a capsule, and you want, so let's say we can go back to your example, your first question, which was, let's say, ibuprofen, and we want to design an ibuprofen tablet. And, you know, because people, you know, say you want to use it to treat your sore knee or whatever else. So we need to design a dosage form to deliver that chemical, that ibuprofen, to the site of action. Because, and in most cases, when we want to get a drug to the site of action, it's usually swallowed. If we can, it's an oral. Oral is always preferred because it's easier to take. So we rely on the circulatory system, our bloodstream, to carry the drug once it's absorbed to the site of action in the body. So your knee, where it has its anti-inflammatory effects. So if we have a brand name drug or a generic drug, if the API is the same, we don't actually need to do clinical studies with the generic. All we need to do is we need to show that the two different brands, the brand and the generic, are absorbed in the same manner. So to do this, we do what are called bioequivalent studies. So what we do is we test the brand name drug, we test it in a bunch of volunteers, and then we test the generic, and we measure the blood levels periodically. So you say you take the pill, and then, you know, in 15 minutes we'll do a blood sample, in 30 minutes we'll do a blood sample, we'll do another blood sample, and we graph it. We measure the amount in the bloodstream. So we'll give you the brand name drug and we'll give you the generic drug. And then we'll see, did the drug get absorbed to this, you know, the same rate and extent? And if the same API is absorbed to the same rate and extent, then we say, yeah, the drug is basically equivalent. Then we do some statistical calculations to show that basically it's superimposable, the two graphs. So we graph it and we just show that they're superimposed. And that gives us the assurance that the drugs are basically the same. So there are certainly complaints that the generic isn't the same or people have adverse reactions to it. And I think it's important also to keep in mind that there's no requirement for the generic drug to contain the same non-medicinal ingredients. So if the API has to be the same, but there's other parts of things, there's other things in the chemical. Are there other things in the tablet or capsule that are really there just to help the drug, you know, dissolve quickly and be absorbed quickly into the body? And there might be slight differences, and there could be the chance for rare allergies. But I find a lot of complaints are often around what are called the nocebo effects. And the nocebo is actually the opposite of placebo. So they're the negative symptoms that are created by negative expectations from the patient. So if I tell the patient they've got a generic, and say I tell them like, oh, this is a generic, and I say it in a way that they're, you know, it creates a perception that the generic's inferior, then it's probably a lot more likely that they're going to complain about that generic. But if I provide them with the assurances that say generics are evaluated in a way that's, you know, common across most countries in the world, that these are rigorous standards, that, you know, millions of people are given generic drugs every day, and there's few, if any, adverse effects noted. In fact, that when there are studies that are done regarding generic drugs, that the regulatory framework really gives us a confidence to say that they actually are interchangeable. And so I think a lot of it is perception around those effects. So let's go back to the original question. So, I mean, I think that's pretty much the truth as it is. And the interesting thing is that most countries have exactly the same methods for evaluating generic drugs, because they're accepted to be, you know, very accurate in helping to assure us that you can substitute between these two different brands without having any worries about the lack of efficacy.
Is the phrase big pharma like a big red flag to you at this point?
It can be, definitely. I'm always kind of amused by that statement, because you know, the pharmaceutical companies are a large collection of different companies, and some are very big and some are very small, and usually the small ones want to become quite big, and the big ones are, you know, there's a few big ones. But I think that I think that when we're using, you know, terms like big pharma, I think that it does obscure our kind of what we can, you know, the criticisms that we may have. And certainly there's bad behavior on the part of pharmaceutical companies that is certainly valid for criticism. But when we're kind of using it, like when we're using the term of, you know, big money and big pharma, I think it obscures from the fact that it's often used big pharma and, you know, big pharma is bad, and, you know, big herba or big, you know, big supplement is small and, you know, and good. And it's, you know, these are all companies. These are all for-profit companies, and they all manufacture products. And in fact, Eric Davis at the Skeptic North blog did a really interesting post a year or two ago, looking at the research and development budgets for the herbal manufacturers in Canada, and comparing them to the pharmaceutical companies, and observed that there's no shortage of profit that's taking place within the herbal supplement manufacturers. And they actually spend quite a bit less on research and development than do the pharmaceutical companies.
Interesting. But how do you balance that? How do you keep giving like good science-based advice, knowing that sometimes it is going to turn out like thalidomide? Because thalidomide is my go-to horrible pharmaceutical story.
Well, thalidomide's a good one. I actually did I've had this post before. I did a post on this because it's I've had this comment thrown at me. It's like, oh yeah, thalidomide, where's your science now, pharmacy boy? And I mean, I think that the case of thalidomide is one that actually shows that regulatory systems that are in place when the regulatory systems are properly designed actually work. And when we looked at, you know, thalidomide wasn't a disaster in the United States as it was in other countries because there was the regulator demanded additional studies related to safety, the safety of the product that hadn't been done in other countries. It didn't have regulatory standards in place that required those types of tests. And so we look at thalidomide as a public health disaster. It certainly led to the changes that are in place for the regulatory systems that now set the safety standards for pharmaceuticals. And I think that's certainly why a lot of health practitioners have a lot of concerns about the safety standards that are put in place for non-drug products, because just because something is natural doesn't necessarily mean that it's safe. And so we have concerns whenever there's a lowered bar for either safety or efficacy for products.
And we'll be back with more of pharmacist Scott Gavura after these brief messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're diving back into the fascinating world of numbers, from the toughest theoretical concepts to the numbers that describe our favorite pastimes. Guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to science writer Brian Clegg about his book, A Brief History of Infinity, The Quest to Think the Unthinkable, which describes the surprisingly human endeavor to understand and describe the unimaginably large concepts that define the universe. And Desiree Schell talks to physicist Aaron Santos about his entertaining new book, Ballparking, Practical Math for Impractical Sports Questions. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by pharmacist Scott Gavura of the blogs Science-Based Medicine and Science-Based Pharmacy. So since I have you here, could we just talk about how the American FDA is different from Health Canada, the Canadian counterpart? Like, do they basically work in the same way?
I think it depends. Certainly what Health Canada regulates, what the FDA regulates is different. In general, how they approach the regulation is different. The FDA, I would say, is far more transparent than Health Canada when it comes to disclosing information on the status of reviews. From another perspective, you could say that they largely do a very similar role when it comes to drug regulation, which is, you know, the manufacturer will make a submission and request for the approval to market a drug for a particular use, and the manufacturer has to submit an enormous amount of information about the safety and efficacy of the drug, a number of clinical trials, whether published or not, regarding the effectiveness or efficacy of that drug, and the regulator makes a decision about whether that drug can be sold or not. I think there's a lot of harmonization, not just between the FDA and between FDA and Health Canada, but I think internationally as well, regarding kind of the standards of what's acceptable and what has to be submitted in order just to make it easier for pharmaceutical companies, because, you know, they can't design a separate clinical trial to meet every regulator's expectations. And so there's what's called the ICH, which is, I think it's International Council on Harmonization, which has established a lot of the, you know, joint, you know, standards internationally for what's going to be accepted by a regulator. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities. There's also a lot of dissimilarities as well. Certainly when it comes to things like supplements and things like homeopathy, there's quite a bit of difference in terms of what's regulated. And that's really, you know, those are really kind of a number of different factors will determine what the regulatory system really looks like. I'm more familiar with Health Canada and the FDA, but, you know, the UK system is also very similar in part to a lot of aspects of Health Canada, and then the European system as well, as there's a lot of similarities as well. All of those regulators, as I said, you know, been influenced by a lot of the same events. Certainly thalidomide that you mentioned was a major one, which were really to set in place that requiring manufacturers to demonstrate safety and efficacy before drugs are marketed.
All right. That one was just for me. But let's get to a few more audience questions. This one's from Tom.
Antibiotics are included in so many more products than they used to be. Dish detergent, toothpaste, and cleaning products all have antibiotic agents. Does this contribute to the increasing number of drug-resistant bacterium we're seeing? If that's the case, why is it still a common practice?
I don't know if they're necessarily classified as antibiotics. I mean, I think in a lot of consumer products, they may be antiseptic and they may be antibacterial, but they're not antibiotics in the same way that the products that we would be taking under prescription would be the case. I think that the biggest concern that exists regarding antibiotics are antibiotics used in the food supply system, particularly in the way that that are being used in livestock and in animals that we are subsequently consuming. And I think my understanding is the vast majority of antibiotics are used in that setting and not in the not in humans. And so certainly the more that we use antibiotics, the more concerns that we have regarding the emergence of resistance. And that is a very real case with some medical conditions. And we've seen some antibiotics become, you know, there's relative resistance that has emerged over, you know, over decades regard to certain bugs and certain drugs. But I think it's also reassuring that, you know, there's some antibiotics that are, you know, still in use, that, you know, they were in use when I went through pharmacy school in the early 90s, and they were in use far before then, and they're still in use. So it's difficult to say what the effects, long-term effects are, but I think that it's, I think everyone would agree that we should minimize as much as possible the unnecessary use of antibiotics.
So what's the difference between antibacterial and antibiotic?
Now, I think that really refers to kind of the mechanism of how the products are actually killing the microbe in general. But so, I probably can't comment more on that credibly without you allowing me to use my computer, which
right.
I know you're not.
Scott's not allowed to type. He types very loudly. Well, then I'm wondering, so is there any worry about antibacterial products?
Well, I think that, yeah, that there, my understanding is that there are worries about whether those products are advantageous or not. I certainly, when we talked about cough and cold products, I think that, you know, there are the antibacterial, there's the antibacterial gels that you can use. And those are, you know, those are mainly ethyl alcohol, so just alcohol that you would consume. But, and those are effective. You can't really develop resistance to ethyl alcohol because basically those like lyse the bacteria. And so it's pretty hard to develop resistance to those. But when you look at whether they're effective or not, I think that hand washing is still actually superior. So hand washing with soap and water is actually superior.
This one's from James.
I found that pharmacists are far more aware of adverse drug interactions than doctors, but it still seems you have to outright ask about them. Is there a good website that I can go to so that I can do my own research?
I think it's difficult to say. I mean, if you're looking for a list of adverse reactions, I think that there's a number of databases that exist that, that are available to health professionals. I'm not sure what's available publicly. I think the interesting thing to keep in mind, and this is what I always find really interesting, Desiree, is most of what you see when you get your warning, when you get your prescription and you get your information leaflet or you look it up online, it'll give you a long list of adverse effects. Most of those adverse effects that are listed are because the drug was studied in a clinical trial, and it will list all the drugs that were studied in a clinical trial. So what I find fascinating is when you know there's a supplement being used and they'll say, look, there's no adverse effects. Well, that's because it's never been put into a clinical trial. And
really?
So it's never actually been systematically studied. Yeah. Yeah. So if you've never put the drug in a trial and compared it to placebo and actually looked to see what are the adverse effects that are reported, you don't really have a very systematic way of calculating that. Generally, when we look at a clinical trial, we say what were the adverse effects, and it's usually nausea and vomiting and other things. And but what we really want to know is how did they differ from placebo, right? And we were talking about Houdia. Well, Houdia seemed to cause much more nausea and vomiting than placebo, so we'd say, well, that's probably an effect of the product. The second way we collect adverse effects, and I've written about this as well at Science-Based Medicine, is that we rely on different forms of what are called post-marketing surveillance. So these are different systems that are in place to actually track safety information after the drug is already on the market. And I think that we would all agree that probably the system that we have in place is probably inferior for collecting the vast majority of adverse effects. And so you know, health professionals, if, you know, you ask about an adverse effect, whether it's associated with a drug or not, then we can search through a number of different databases to say whether it's been reported or not. Then we can think about, like, what actually is the chemical, and is this something that we might expect to be possible because of the drug itself? Are there drug effects that we might think, yeah, that could be possible? And then, you know, either the health professional or consumers can actually report their own adverse effects directly to regulators. So they can say, you know, we're not implying that it's causally related. We're just saying it's an association between I took a drug and I had some sort of a reaction or something, and I believe that there may be the possibility that it's related to the drug. And we can't always assume that that is the case, but through through adverse event reporting, then we can hopefully collect more information on this that hopefully will better inform the information we can give to consumers later. And you see this sometimes where there will be warnings that will emerge from the FDA or from Health Canada saying there's new safety information that's emerged. So, you know, when we're doing a clinical trial on a drug prior to it being released, the drug may be only studied in, you know, a few hundred people. So it might be a very small population. It could be thousands of people. It really depends on the drug. But the population may be small. And if an adverse effect is truly associated with a drug, but it only occurs in 1 in 100,000, then you probably won't see that in a clinical trial. And consequently, it's very difficult to identify those until well after the drug is actually on the market.
And that is good information. But actually, James said drug interactions.
Oh.
So no, you did. Also, good information. But is it the same principle for drug interactions?
It is the same. It is the same principle too. So when we're looking at drug interactions, we would say, you know, what do we know about the drug? What do we know about how the drug is metabolized in the body? What specific enzymes metabolize the drug? Can we make predictions based on the way we know how this drug is metabolized in the body and eliminated, that there are certain drugs that it will interact with? Then we would look at case reports and things that emerge after a drug is released to understand, you know, there's a new interaction here that we didn't know about. And this occurs with food as well. You know, there's some drugs interact with grapefruit juice because of components within grapefruit juice. And that wasn't even identified until there was actually a clinical trial that was being done that was looking at the drug. And they were trying to disguise the taste of the drug when they were mixing with placebo and by putting it in grapefruit juice. And they found that it threw the drug levels way off because the grapefruit juice was causing an interaction with the active ingredient in the drug and that was being studied.
And again, we have so many more questions that I can't possibly get to because we're out of time. Scott, thanks very much for being here again.
Oh, I enjoyed it. What I'll do is I'll commit to putting some links for some of the additional information for the questions I wasn't able to answer as completely as I'd liked.
That's wonderful. Thanks, sir.
Okay.
You'll find links to Scott Gavura's writing at Science-Based Pharmacy and Science-Based Medicine, both of which we've linked to on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, keep clicking the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that we can keep you posted on show news, and also iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to back episodes, or write a warm and heartfelt review, perhaps. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. And one last thing. Tom, a listener in Peterborough, Ontario, is trying to start up a free thinkers group. He's looking for any and all other free thinkers, atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and humanists to join the Facebook group so that you can all arrange a meetup of some kind. If you'd like more information, check out the Peterborough Free Thinkers group on Facebook. Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.